Well, if you'd open your Bibles to Job chapter 1 and Job chapter 38. Well, that's pretty good. Last time there was a big sigh when you say Job. Everyone, oh. Job. Can we talk about something else? Job 1 and Job 38. By the way, if you don't have a Bible, we're going to put almost all the verses that I'm going to read tonight up for you on our new screens with our new overheads and make it easy for you. There we go, a little bouncing dot and everything. So, yeah, hi, Missy. You ever feel like you have to apologize for God? Like, I'm talking to a friend of yours about the Bible, and a question comes up, and it's one of those hard verses, and you think, oh gosh, I wish it didn't say that in the Bible. But it does. It's right there. Something about maybe Jesus being the only way. And it just doesn't sound very intellectually satisfying to think that Jesus is the only way. So you kind of want to say, well, you know, I mean, that's not really what it means. Matter of fact, I heard about a pastor saying to his congregation last weekend that a Christian church told his church that Jesus is not the only way. I think he just gave in to the overwhelming pressure that just doesn't sound right. There's got to be other ways. There's only one God. Or when Jesus said, take up your cross daily and follow me. You know, die to yourselves. Jesus was in a bad mood that day. He didn't really mean that. There's other verses like having life and having it abundantly that are much more positive. Let's think about those verses instead. Or how about when God tells Saul, why don't you go to the Amalekites and kill everybody? Men, women, children, cattle, everybody. We kind of wish those verses weren't there sometimes. Like maybe God just had a bad night. Just didn't get enough sleep that night, and he just was a little angry that one day. And we kind of want to say, look, you have to understand God. He's sometimes unpredictable. You ever feel that way? You like to just look over those hard verses and go on, and we want to take away the mystery, if you would. We want to take some of the awe and the fear away from God and make him into a little bit more of a manageable, softer God sometimes when it suits our needs. Maybe I'm the only person who feels that way. So we want to rewrite the Bible. Maybe we want to ignore the hard passages. There was a quote from Abraham Lincoln when he was asked one day during the Civil War. Someone said to him, do you think that God is on our side? And he said, you know what? It's not whether God is on our side, but whether we are on God's side. You see the difference there? It's not whether God's on our side, but it's whether we are on his side. I believe that a lot of times we want to make God into our little genie, our little Aladdin. Our own personal Jesus was a song by Depeche Mode not too long ago. Big hit everywhere. The idea being that, hey, you can have your own personal Jesus who will come and be your personal buddy, your friend, and make life just wonderful like Aladdin would. I'm not quite sure that's what God had in mind when Jesus came to earth and died on a cross, was to just be our personal Jesus. We say things like we want to accept him into our heart, but do we talk in the language of saying we've been accepted by God? We've been accepted by him. I think a lot of language we use is very controlling language. We want to make him controllable, manageable. We want to put God in a box. He's much more manageable when he's in a box. Versus when, as Hector's saying tonight, when he's high above. His ways are not our ways. We create God in our own image sometimes, don't we? Rather than him creating us in his image and us fitting into his plans, we want to make him fit into our plans. We want him to bless and bless and bless us. But do we bless him and worship him in spirit and truth? And we can kind of create some golden calves, can't we, sometimes? Just like Aaron did. We can create a God that we want that's much more fun, much more manageable, to use that word again. And you know what? What this is an attack on the image of God. And I shared this with you last time I spoke on Father's Day weekend, that image is everything. I agree with Andre Agassi. I agree that image is very, very powerful. And how we see God will interpret how we respond to Him and how we live according to Him. The image of God is vital that we sustain the highest, most biblical image that we can. Now, if you were here at the prayer meeting Wednesday night, Mike Maffey showed you, a tract. This is an advertisement from a skateboarding magazine. This is the best-selling skateboarding magazine in the country. This is a tract. This looks like exactly like a tract that you might see from a Christian. But here it is. It's a happy face, and it's the devil. And he says, "Let's make a deal." Okay? On the inside, it's a color tract, like you might see us handing out to someone on the street. And what this whole tract is the devil is saying, "Look, I got a bum deal. God is no fun. And God kicked me out of heaven. And because I was trying to have a good time with all my friends skateboarding and having a good time and drinking a few beers, God threw me out of heaven, made all these laws, and God is just lame. And in fact, if you want to follow me, here's what you should do." And there's a contract here. "I, the undersigned, do hereby give possession of my soul to the devil for eternity, forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever." That's what it says. And then you can send in and spend $5 and get this shirt that says, "I sold my soul and all I got was this lousy t-shirt." And you know how this thing works? It attacks the image of God. It mocks the image of God. This is not the image of God, biblically speaking. Image matters. And that's why it's important that we hold the highest image of God as He Himself defines Himself. And it's not just in the world where we want to recreate and re-edit the Bible. Even in the church, we change the real holy image of God and bring Him down to just above us. If this is my opinion. We bring Him down to a level where He's just a little bit above us. He's just a little bit out of reach, but He's much more understandable, and He seems a little bit more fair when we put Him that way. We take away the fear element, if you would, make Him more manageable. Now, God is sovereign. You ever hear that word before? It's one of those big words. God is sovereign. What does that mean? What does sovereignty mean? I have a definition for you. Sovereignty is God's freedom from outward restraint. God's freedom from outward restraint. His unlimited rule of mankind and control over His creation. God's freedom from outward restraint. His unlimited rule of mankind and control over His creation. That's sovereignty. That's sovereignty. Sovereign nation. You've heard of things like this. It's a sovereign nation. Governs itself. Now, does that definition of God bother anybody? There's no appeals court. There's no senior God. You go talk to you feeling like God. Make your case to somebody else. "I'm going to go above you, God. I'm going to whoever's above you. I'm going to go see that person, that God." God has no accountability partner that you can go talk to and say, "Well, did you know about God? Somebody said to me one time in His Word." Better straighten him out. God is totally sovereign. Now, in case you don't know or doubt that's a fair definition of sovereignty of God, let's read two passages from Paul's letters, one from Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 11 says, "In Him we were also chosen, having been predestined according to the plan of Him who works everything." According to the plan of Him who works everything in conformity with the purpose of His will. God works everything in conformity with the purpose of His will. Not my will, not your will, not our will. He works everything in conformity with the purpose of His will. He is a sovereign God. Philippians 2:13 says, "For it is God who works in you," in us, "to will and to act according to" who? "To what? His good purpose." God is at work according to His good purpose. He is completely sovereign and He answers to nobody. God does not answer to anybody. Does He need to? Does that bother anybody? That God doesn't have to answer to anybody? And we know that His will is good. So He's working at all good things according to His good purpose. Is that what the devil told Eve in the garden? Hey, God is kind of working for your good purpose, but no. He let her know in kind of no uncertain terms that, hey, God's holding out on you. God's not telling you everything. Phrasing questions like, did God really say? Is it just really an attempt to undermine the sovereignty and knowledge and character of our God? And the devil has continued to this day to undermine the character and image of God. In fact, that's what that whole tract's about. It's undermining the character of God. Now, let's look at Job. Let's see how Job ties into this whole discussion on sovereignty and who God is and what He does. Now, in case you don't know about the book of Job, Job is the story, initially, of a talk between the devil and God. The devil's roaming around looking for someone to devour. He approaches the throne of God. They have a discussion. God says, well, have you considered my servant Job? Job. He's a blameless man. There's no one like him. Well, the devil says, hey, he only serves you because you bless him. Let's see what happens if all the things that you've given to him are gone. Will he serve you? And eventually, he's going to lose everything, right? Everything except his wife, which he's going to wish he lost next chapter, you know, if you know the story. So he's lost everything. Let's go to verse 18. It may not be on the screen for you, but I'll read verse 18 to verse 20. While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. He's lost everything. His family, his cattle, his donkeys, everything. What does Job do? Verse 20. At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship. That's not what I would have done. And said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. I couldn't do that. That's not my natural response to disaster, calamity, to trial, to hardship. I mean, there's a lot less severe things that happen to me, and I'm not falling on the ground and praising God. But I believe, in my limited knowledge, that Job understood what Paul wrote about the sovereignty of God. And I believe that Job knew that this must be the hand of God and worshiped. And he bowed down and he worshiped. How good does something have to appear before we can give God praise? Think about that. How good does something have to appear before we can give God praise? Do we sit there and evaluate praise reports in our mini church and say, praise the Lord. Praise the Lord! That was great! You got to go tell Zach about that one. Write a story. I mean, if God's will is being worked out and revealed in our lives in every step, in conformity with His will, could we rejoice in everything? What does Zach say when you talk to him? When you ask him, how are you doing, Zach? What's he say? Thankful. Every time. Every minute I see him of the day, any day of the week. How are you doing, Zach? Thankful. Why? It's not just something that it's not just wrote. The whole point is to be thankful is to be reminded of what God's doing and has done and will do in our lives. He's trained himself to see through circumstances and to give God glory and to give him thanks because of Because we're saved. Right? How good does it have to appear? Remember Joseph? When he met his brothers again after he'd been given up, lost, for dead, sold. They come back and he wants to, you can feel the tension of him wanting to pay him back. And he hides his tears and he says, "I'm Joseph." And their response is appropriate. And his is, he says, "Don't worry. What you had intended for evil or harm, God intended for good." That's understanding the sovereignty of God. Are you with me? That's understanding that God is working things out according to His good purposes for His good pleasure. Have you ever been 828'd before? 828'd. You know, Romans 8:28. You know, you're going through a lousy day and you lost your job or you're having a bad time with your wife or something like that, and someone says, "Well, Romans 8:28. Oh, God works all good things." Right? Right. Thanks. This is what I needed to hear. Right? "And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him and have been called according to His purpose." His purpose. We tend to chop out the bottom three lines, don't we? "And we know that in all things God works for the good." But we forget that God works for the good of His purpose. For those that love Him. God is at work. Now, I'm the first one to not like being 828'd. It's better to give than receive. When it comes to Romans 8:28, isn't it? Right? It's better to say, "Phew, Romans 8:28. Phew." But you know what? It's true, isn't it? I mean, it's completely true. It's a principle, and it's true, but it may not be timely. You know what I'm saying? There may not be a time to have someone say to you, Romans 8:28. There's a time when you sit with somebody and say, "I'm sorry. Can I pray for you? Can I just be with you during your hard time?" Even though the principle is true. But when we can step back for a moment, we can realize that God is accomplishing His will, and it's good, and then can we hang on to Him? Rather than stand back and point our finger at Him, can we draw close to God? Can we draw near to Him in our time and our season of doubt? Can we draw near and come under the shelter of His wings and stay close to Him and say, "Lord, through this hard time, be with me. I want to draw near to You," rather than stand back and say, "Why?" He's sovereign. He answers to no one. He answers to no one. Well, the meat of the book of Job, from Job chapter 3 on to about 30, is Job's three comforters, they're called, which is kind of sarcastic, but it's not very comforting. And they try to tell Job, try to explain to him why this has happened to him. "Job, you must have done something, because God works in cause and effect. You must have sinned, or else God wouldn't bring this on to you." Do you ever do that before with somebody? I've done it before. I'm sorry to say it. If I've done it to you, I apologize. You're going through a hard time, and I kind of interview you. What's going on in your life? Are you praying? Aha! That's what you've got to pray more. That's the problem. You tithed? You didn't tithe. That's the problem. That's why this has happened to you. I don't think it's that way, folks. I mean, I've learned the hard way. I don't think that God is just cause and effect. I think there's more to it than just that. That's part of us making Him a little bit higher than us, where He's just a little bit more higher than us. We can almost explain away what He's doing. And Job begins to buy into this lengthy discussion of why. And Job begins to say things like, you know, he wants to know. And we, as we read along with Job, we think, yeah, why? What's happening here? Kind of reminds me of computer speeds. How many of you have computers? Work on a computer or have one at home? I'm still doing the thing like I would, like if I was typing. Now, I know just a little bit to know. I don't know what a modem is yet, but I know you have to have one. I'm too slow to have a conversation on the internet because by the time I want to get in, it's already gone. You know, like. But I have friends, and some of them are here, and you know who you are. But you have this, I just found out that a Pentium is higher than a 486. I didn't know what that was for a long time. Is Pentium a product? Is Pentium like a? No, I know now it's a really fast computer. But I know people that say I have to have a new computer because mine's too slow. Oh, well, what does that mean? Well, I have to wait a long time for it to do what I want it to do. Well, what's a long time? I mean, they get on. Come on already! Oh, there it is. It's on now. What, 3 seconds? I'm not kidding. And you know I'm talking to you, a lot of you, right? I need a faster computer. What, you had to wait 3 seconds for the whole world's information to pop up in front of you? The whole world in front of you, and you wait 3 seconds is too long. I can't. Kurt has this new disc of volumes and volumes and volumes of church information, church history. I'm thinking this is amazing on one disc. And there's people who are going to say, I want it faster than 3 seconds. I want it in 2 seconds. And they'll spend $4,000 to get it faster. That's amazing. And I believe we bring that same mentality into our walk with God. God, I prayed about it yesterday. What's up? You got my beeper number. You got my fax number. I mean, what's, you know, we misconnect somehow? I mean, you know, I mean, God forbid that we should pray on something from like a week or two, you know, and not have an answer. I sure hope God isn't feeling the pressure that technology is making things harder for him now, you know? I mean, Jeremiah, 40 years looking for one convert. Repent! Oh my gosh. I mean, you go on and on and on about the Old Testament heroes, they would laugh at us. You want a faster computer? I'd be thrilled to have a computer. A 186. Did they make 186s? Did they ever make those? Whatever they want. An 8 would be great, you know? Wow, it's amazing. We want to know, God, why? No way. We cry out, God, why is this happening to me? And tell me why, and tell me now. Finally, Job gives in. And he makes this charge to God. You're not going to believe this. Job chapter 31, verse 35. This is Job's statement to God. Oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense. He signs his statement, his charge. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put his indictment in writing. God, I sign mine. Boom. You sign yours. Talk to me. Now, whoa, we say maybe that's not a good idea. I'm not sure we want to do that, Job. Let me ask you a question. Who brought harm to Job, God or the devil? Okay, we have a little vote, aren't we? Okay, who says that God brought harm to Job? Raise your hand. Okay, who says the devil brought harm to Job? Who says, I don't know. Well, who does Job blame? Who does Job hold accountable? God, right? Doesn't he say? The Lord gave, the Lord takes away. Chapter 2 tells his wife, should we not accept good and not harm from the Lord? In the very end of the book, the very end of Job 42, it says that his friends brought to him gifts to console him for the harm the Lord had brought to him. These are serious matters, aren't they? I'm reading a book called Liberated Through Submission. My wife's making me read it. I could might like that, actually. This is a statement from Bunny Wilson, and she says, talking about her sister, who was a year older than her and was retarded, blind, and deformed, she says, I see now that I was never an atheist. I was merely a person who accepted the easiest solution when I could not answer life's difficult questions. She tried to understand why was her sister like this. And she would accept the easiest solution when it came to life's most difficult questions. Remember when Jesus is with his apostles and they see a man born blind and they say to him in John chapter 9, why is this man born blind? Did he sin or his parents sin? They've already got him in categories. It's got to be cause and effect, right? It has to be. Somebody had to sin or else this man wouldn't be born blind. And what does Jesus say? Neither. Neither. He was born blind so that the power of God may be displayed in his life. There may be things in your life right now that aren't the way you want them to be. It may not be the way you would have designed it to be for your life. Whether it's circumstance, it's something physical, it's something family related, and it's not the way you wanted it to be. But I would agree with Jesus and say, in principle, that things are the way they are so that God's work may be displayed in you for His glory. So that whether you believe that God allows evil and suffering, or you believe that God plans evil and suffering, whether you believe that God stood back and said to the devil, go ahead and do what you want to, but you can't do this, or you believe that God worked through the devil to accomplish his purposes directly through him to Job's life, ultimately God is responsible. Ultimately, God could have either prevented it or God planned it for his purposes to work things out according to his glory. Either way, God is responsible. And Job does not blame anybody else but God. And God doesn't deny responsibility. So we can stand, can't we, with Job to some degree and say, yeah, okay, God, tell him why. And we say, God, tell me why. Why was I born like this? Why is my life like this? Why is my marriage like this? Why is my job like this? Why don't I have a job right now? And we can stand and agree with Job and get behind him in line and say, yeah, and then answer me too. After you answer him, tell me why. Well, God does answer Job. Let's look at this. Job chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, this is a great line. Boy, if I could ever use this line one day with my kids, I will. Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Can you imagine right there? I mean, out of the storm. I mean, I don't even know. I can't even fathom. You know, there's a storm coming in. Whoa, there's a storm. And then God speaks out of the storm. Who darkens my counsel? Ah! And then he says, brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. I would have said, hey, Job, let me know what happens, okay? Let's read on a little bit here. This is a great conversation. It's a one-way conversation. Verse 4, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? Let's go over to verse 19. What is the way to the abode of light? What is the way to the sun? And where does darkness reside? Can you take me to their places? Do you know the paths to their dwelling? Surely you know, for you were already born. You have lived so many years. Now, does God have a sense of humor? Yeah, it's a little sarcastic, isn't he, there? Verse 34. Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you? Here we are. Isn't that a great picture? Lightning bolts saying to God, send us. Who endowed the heart with wisdom? Who gave understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together? And he will go on and on to the next chapter, to chapter 40, laying out his case for his sovereignty over all creation, over everything. God knows everything. Chapter 40, verse 1. The Lord said to Job, "Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him." Then Job answered the Lord, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice I will say no more." Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me." Now pay attention to this one verse here. "Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Would you condemn me to justify yourself?" What's that mean? You ever try to explain to someone what God is doing when in actuality you want to make yourself feel better for having an answer to something that you don't have an answer for? You follow me? Someone wants to know why they don't have a job, why this is the way it is, why this is the way that it is. And then you, not wanting to be left without an answer, say something that isn't really true. And you, in a sense, condemn God to justify yourself. You, in a sense, step God down from his sovereignty and make him a little bit lower. I know, as a pastor, that I have been faced with many counseling situations in my lifetime, last 10 years. And I must confess to you that I have done exactly that. I have condemned God to justify myself. I have said things that I knew weren't really true, but could have been true, and sounded like they were good enough to be true, but in reality, I wanted to have an answer. I wanted to bring some short-term measure of comfort. And I was afraid to stand on the sovereignty of God itself and say, "I don't know. I don't know." And I think we sell God short. I think we make him a little bit lower when we do that. And that, to me, is the strongest language in this whole book. Let me ask you, if you were the one that got the call to go to someone's house, to go bring comfort to someone who'd lost a very dear friend or a loved one, and you were the one that was called to go, you were the religious person that they knew, and you were the one that they wanted to go and talk and then explain and bring comfort and explain why their husband was killed or their wife was killed or their child was lost, what do you say? You want to do something right. You want to help out. And you're tongue-tied. And probably rightfully so. Or can we bring this into more personal terms? How do you deal with your own personal struggles? How do you cope with the questions that you can't answer when you want to stand behind Job in line and say, "Yeah, how come? Answer me. I want to know." How do we respond to that? How do we respond to the mysteries of God and the mysteries of the things that happen in our lives? When I walked through a period of time, and I taught on this a few years ago, time of darkness, a verse that came to me that still brings me comfort is Isaiah 50:10. And God says, "Let him who walks in darkness and has no light, let him trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God." When we go through times we have no light, let us trust in the name of the Lord and rely on our God. Let us depend on him. The real issue comes down to, do we know our God? Do we know him by his name? Can we rely and trust in the name of the Lord? Here's how I would want us to respond to anybody else or to our own selves when it comes down to why is God doing what he's doing. I've got these verses for you. I'm going to read them to you in sort of a response. My response to myself and to others would be this, to trials or hardship would be, I don't know why God does what he does. But I know my God, and my God is holy and he is jealous. My God is a God who is compassionate and gracious. He's slow to anger. He's abounding in love and faithfulness. God maintains love to thousands. He forgives wickedness, rebellion, and sin. He is a God who arms me with strength for battle. His way is perfect. He is a shield for all who take refuge in him. My God stoops down to make me great. My God has mercy on me. He provides safety until disaster has passed. Many trust in chariots and horses. Many will trust in chariots and horses, but I trust in the name of the Lord our God. Psalm 20, verse 7. I will trust in the name of the Lord our God. I will not put my trust in the counsel of men. I will not put my trust in the chariots and horses and armies, in my pastor, in my spouse. I will not put my trust in anyone other than the name of the Lord our God. You know what? God never does answer Job, does he? He never answers him directly, but he does, doesn't he? What's his answer? To question me. Who are you to question me? I am who I am. I am the sovereign Lord who works everything in conformity to his will. And his will is good. Do we believe that? I want to call Hector back on the worship team. I'm going to read a short story to you from a book called The Wind in the Willows. Do you know that book? It's a great little illustration to me of the awesomeness of God and the love of God at the same time. His awesomeness and his love. This is a little story, a little vignette about the mole and the rat. And the rat is going to take the mole to the place where he finds God. He's going to tell him about it. I want to take you to the place where I meet God. Rat says this: "This is the place of my song dream, the place the music played to me," whispered the rat, as if in a trance. "Here, in this holy place, here, if anywhere, surely we will find him." We'll find God. Then suddenly the mole felt a great awe fall upon him, an awe that turned his muscles to water, bowed his head, rooted his feet to the ground. It was no panic terror. Indeed, he felt wonderfully at peace and happy, but it was an awe that smote him and held him. Without seeing, he knew that it could only mean that some august presence was very, very near. Trembling, he looked to Rat. "Rat," he found the breath to whisper, are you afraid?" "Afraid," murmured the rat, his eyes shining with unutterable love. "Afraid? Afraid of him? Oh, never, never. And yet, O mole, I am afraid." Then the two animals, crouching to the earth, bowed their heads and did worship. I love that imagery of a God who freezes us in terror, a holy terror, but with an unutterable love at the same time. When he is near, we sense him in his awesomeness and his fullness. You know what? No man-made trivial God can do that. No God we can make or create will freeze you to the ground, cause your legs to buckle, and fill you with tremendous awe and wonder. Only a sovereign God is worthy of our praise. Amen? Let's praise him.
You are mighty, you are holy, you are awesome in your power. You have risen. You have conquered. You have beaten.